Let's pick up where we left off from last week. We left off in Leviticus chapter 25. Okay, we're slowly but surely getting through this book. It's been a very, very difficult book in many ways, and I think it's one of the books where most Christians, most people, even most ministers just try to avoid, simply because there's so much to it that it's very difficult to draw out in terms of its spiritual meaning and significance. But if you take this book in light of all other scripture, I think there's a great deal there that makes spiritual parallels. Every time that you read something in Leviticus or even in any of the writings of Moses that really doesn't, let's say, have an application for us today, it still has a very profound spiritual application and significance. And this is very true with this chapter 25 in Leviticus, because God's setting down some laws in terms of the sabbatical years, in terms of the Jubilee years, and even though we're not under these laws today, they still have very profound significance as far as their spiritual application. So beginning in verse 1 in chapter 25, it says, Then the Lord spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards and gather its crops. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field, nor prune your vineyards. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And all of you shall have the same Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves and your hired hand and your foreign residents, those who live as aliens with you. Even your cattle and your animals that are in your land shall have its crops to eat." Now, before we go any further, what he's talking about here is referred to as the sabbatical year.
Hi, John.
Hi, Dad. Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Okay.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, we just got started in Leviticus chapter 25. This is known as a sabbatical year, okay? And basically what God is saying is this. Every seventh year, you are not to plant any crops. You are not to, you know, till your soil and plant the seeds and to harvest or anything like that. You are to just let your land lie fallow. You're not to touch it. He says anything that grows by itself, you're more than welcome to eat. It's there for you. It's there for the strangers. It's there for the aliens. And it's there for the animals. But you are not to till your soil, and you're not to plant crops for that year. Now, we know now, looking back, I mean, agriculturally, that is a very, very wise thing to do, because if you just continue to plant crops year after year after year, if you never give your land an opportunity to rest, I mean, it's going to draw out of it all the minerals, all the nutrients that are in the soil, and your crops are going to be, you know, either withered or they're just not going to have the nutrients that God intended them to have. Now, God specifically is doing this for several different reasons, okay? It's a sabbatical year. In other words, he's telling them, look, you need to trust me. On the sixth year, I'm going to give you a bumper crop. And the bumper crop is going to be such that it's going to last you that sixth year, it's going to last you through the seventh year, and it's even going to last you through the eighth year. Even though you're going to plant the eighth year, it'll last you up to the time that you harvest your crop. So what it involves here is trusting God. Now, he has already disciplining his people in this same vein because of the manna in the wilderness. He says, okay, for 6 days you are to gather the manna. But he told them, every day you gather the manna, there's not to be any left over. And people who said, well, gee, I don't know if it would be manna tomorrow morning, so they decided to leave some manna and store it up. It went rancid. It became eaten with worms. So what God was trying to say is, okay, on the sixth day, I'm going to give you twice as much manna. You can go ahead and collect twice as much so that you'll have enough to hold you over through Saturday, through the Sabbath, so that you don't have to work. Because he's trying to instill into them the necessity to rest upon the Sabbath, because the Sabbath pointed to Jesus Christ in terms of his finished work. In other words, everything that Christ done for us, if we don't rest in that, we say, well, I believe in Jesus, but I just feel like I have to work my way to heaven by doing all kinds of different things. Then you're not going to get there. Or how many people think that, well, I believe in God, but I'm basically a good person, so I don't really have to commit myself to Christ the way some people think I do, because I'm basically good. So what are they doing? They are trying to work their own way to heaven, whether they realize it or not. And remember, God set down some pretty severe laws in the Old Testament. There's an example that's set down here where one man was gathering firewood on a Sabbath day, And they caught him, and they brought him to Moses, and Moses said, well, I'll go ask God what we should do to him. God said, this man is to be put to death for gathering firewood. Now, what was God trying to instill in these people? Okay, because when Jesus came, he said, really, the Sabbath was made for man. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath actually was supposed to be from God for a blessing for man. But he was trying to show them that, listen, we have got to rest in the finished work of Jesus Christ. If we don't, if we trust in our own goodness, then the end result is going to be death. If we think that we are basically good and we can work our way to heaven, we are fooling ourselves. That's why it's so important that God emphasized to these people the necessity to rest upon the Sabbath. But he also gave the land a rest. Because remember, when God created the world and then Adam blew it, it wasn't just man that ended up being under this curse. The whole of creation ended up being in the curse. And God said, hey, in the sweat of your face, you shall eat bread. In other words, all of our world is cursed. We can just see it. I mean, everything seems to go from bad to worse. And I think I read one time that, and it's so true, you can't really even go 2 weeks. If you can go 2 weeks without something happening, whether you come down with a cold or an illness or a car wreck or, you know, a fender bender or, you know, a financial setback or whatever. Why? All these things are reminders that, hey, we are under a world that is cursed. And therefore, not only do we need to rest in the finished work of Christ, but the world is looking for that day when it's going to have a new creation under Christ. So the world itself needs that rest. But I'm getting cut off on a tangent here. I'm just simply saying that this sabbatical year was so important to God that it was to steal in them trusting, but it was going to rejuvenate the land. But we are told in Jeremiah and in Chronicles and other portions of Scriptures that what happened was that the people didn't obey God in this area. In other words, when the seventh year came along, they thought, well, you know, we'll just go ahead and plant some crops, and because what was more important to them was being able to, you know, gather in their crops and go and sell it on the marketplace. They were really getting greedy. They wanted their money, and God never said anything. These people would go ahead and plant and reap and sow and whatnot on the seventh year, and this would go by year after year and decade after decade and century after century until after 490 years that they were in the land, God says, you guys are out of this land, and I'm going to throw you out on your ear. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come by, and he's going to wipe you out and incarcerate the rest of you into exile. And he says, you are going to be in Babylon for 70 years, because that way, in 70 years, the land will have its rest. In other words, after 490 years, there was a total of 70 years that land needed to rest, because, you know, it's every seventh year. And so what I'm saying is this. We kind of think to ourselves, why doesn't God act? Why doesn't he move? Why doesn't he do something in this situation, in that circumstance, right? I mean, it just seems like we just wish that he would just come down like a ton of bricks on these people who blaspheme, who mock him, who trample under their feet, his laws and his people and everything like that. And you want, does God see? Does he care? Does he even take account of this? But all the years that the people were disregarding his command in terms of letting their land lie fallow, he was adding it up. It didn't escape his attention. And then after 490 years, after their cup of iniquity began to overflow, he says, okay, you're out of this land, and you're going to be out for 70 years because you didn't keep one of those sabbatical years. Now the land's going to have its rest. So it comes back full circle where God does not forget, even though it seems like he doesn't care. Like I said, when God gives these commands, there's always that spiritual parallel that is so important that we understand, okay? And the same thing when we rest, okay, the land is supposed to get rest in order to get its nutrients, in order to get the minerals back into its soil so that it can continue to grow crops. But the same thing for us. We need to rest in Christ. Every single day is supposed to be the Lord's day, but in a sense, we really need to make that effort to rest in him, because we, too, will become depleted in a spiritual sense. We really do need to seek him out in prayer and scripture study, and really seek his face alone or within fellowship and this type of thing, because if we don't, we are going to be just like the land. It's going to be weakened to the point where it becomes worthless. Now he goes on and he says this in verse 8. He says, you are to also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7 Sabbaths of a year, namely 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month, and on a day of atonement you shall sound a horn to all through your land. And you shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and to each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his own family. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. You shall not sow or reap its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat the crops out of the field. On this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you have a sale, moreover, to your friend, or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of the years of the crops, in proportion to the extent of the years. So you shall increase its price, and in its proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price, for it is a number of crops he is selling to you. So you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. You shall thus observe my Sabbaths and keep my judgments so as to carry them out, that you may live securely on the land. Okay, let me just back up a little bit. Now he's talking about the year of Jubilee. And what this is here is, he says, now you count off, not only do you have the sabbatical year every 7 years, but then you count off up to 49 years, which is seven sabbatical years, excuse me. And so on the 50th year, it is again referred to as a holy year unto the Lord. It's referred to as a year of Jubilee. And do you know what that points to? You know what it prefigures? You know what it's all pointing to? No. It's pointing to the millennial period. It's pointing to when Christ comes back, sets up his millennial kingdom. That's going to be the year of Jubilee. In other words, that's going to be the time when there'll be a new beginning, where everybody will be free. Because the year of Jubilee, in essence, is this. God portioned out, you know, all the land to his people. And he says, that land is your land. And if you, for example, became so destitute financially that you had to sell your land, or and maybe even you became so destitute you had to sell yourself into slavery, what he's saying here is this. At the end of every 50 years, that land comes back to you. No charge. That land will always come back to you because that land belongs to you. In other words, God was setting up a condition, first of all, that nobody can have a monopoly on everything. Like, you know, be a situation where God gave the portion of land out equally to all of his people, and then at the end of 500 years, you got just a handful of people that own everything. Well, no, that's, God made provisions where that wasn't going to happen. If people became poor and they needed to sell their land, they were going to get their land back in the end. But what it was really pointing to is a more profound significance, and that's when all of creation is going to revert back to its original owner. Now, the original owner, of course, was Adam and Eve. But they blew it, they sinned, they failed. In a sense, the deed of ownership to this world was transferred to the devil. He is the God of this world. He is the God of this age, a power and error. We are told that. All right? But Christ came down, and he redeemed us with his blood. But there's coming a day when he's going to come back, and he's going to set up his kingdom on this world. That's what it's pointing to as far as the year of Jubilee, because then the world is going to revert back to its original owner, which is man. And that's what God's intention is, that everybody will then be living in a world where there be peace and harmony and economic and social justice. You know, you won't see the things that are going on today. When Christ is ruling and reigning with his saints in Jerusalem, it's going to be a world that's just filled with love and peace and harmony. And, you know, there's going to be a world where for 1,000 years, the sheep, the wolf, and the lamb, and the lion, they're all going to lay down together. That there's not going to be a situation where we see children dying in infancy from, you know, all kinds of diseases and this type of thing. There will be a limited amount of death during the millennial period, and we are told that in Isaiah, that if a person doesn't live to be 100 years old, he'll believe to be cursed of God. Okay, when Christ is ruling and reigning, all reverts back to its original owner. It's going to be a time of great jubilee, a time of great happiness, they're going to have great satisfaction. The devil and all his demons are going to be bound for 1,000 years, and it's just going to be a, you know, almost like it was before the fall. And that's what this Jubilee is pointing to. But now keep something in mind. Not only does the land revert back to its original owner, but also that year of Jubilee, anybody who had to sell themselves into slavery was going to be freed on the year of Jubilee. But God made a provision that that goes before that. In other words, the provision that he made was this. Every 7 years, that would be basically the sabbatical year. Anyone who had to sell themselves into slavery was to be set free on the seventh year. The land was to revert back to its original owner every 50 years. But every person who sold themselves into slavery would be set free every seventh year. Now, this is very, very significant and very, very important, too, because everything has a spiritual parallel. What did Christ say? Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let me just read on a little bit further, because we need to tie this in when it comes to a person being redeemed or a person being able to get out of slavery that they sell themselves into. Let's just pick up where we left off. Let's pick up with 18. It's somewhere around there. It says, you shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments as to carry them out, that you may live securely in the land. Then the land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops, then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth a crop of 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor that he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or in a case of a man who has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for his redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of his purchaser until the year of Jubilee, but at the Jubilee it shall revert that he may return to his property. Likewise, if a man sells a dwelling, okay, before we go any further here, it's still dealing with the property that people would end up selling, and it would end up reverting back to them. But I think a couple of interesting things about this is that, we look at verse 23, for example, it says, the land, moreover, you shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, and you are but aliens and sojourners with me. That's kind of significant to me, because God is saying that you are a sojourner with me. In other words, when this was written, basically God's saying that he too is a pilgrim on this world. Okay? Because keep something in mind. When God created the world and everything was perfect, he had fellowship with Adam and Eve. He'd come down in the cool of the evening and he'd walk with them and he'd talk with them every single evening. Okay? And it was like God gave the world to man. But God was not a pilgrim in the land. He was not a sojourner. He was very much involved in the lives of his people. But then when sin entered the arena, then he was basically compelled to forsake man, in a sense that he was no longer going to be part of this fellowship with man that they enjoyed. So God today is still a sojourner, but he's a pilgrim, so to speak, with us, as we ourselves, you know, our pilgrims in this world. He is with us as a pilgrim. Why? Because nothing's permanent at this point in time. But there will come a time when everything will be reverted back to its original owner. And its original owner will then have their deed back to the world. It was Jesus Christ who was the one who redeemed this for us. Now, it's talking about here a kinsman redeemer. Okay? It says, now, if a person, let's say my brother, let's say one of my brothers, let's say my brother Greg, if we were living back in those times, and he became poor, destitute, he got in debt, he had to sell his land. Well, I would be one of his closest kin. I would have a right to buy that land back for him. And that's the way God set it up. He said that, you know, if Greg had to sell it to somebody else, I still had the right to go in there and say, well, no, I'm going to buy it for my brother. That's what God wanted me to do, or God wanted his people to do for their kinsmen. I don't know if you remember, we went through the book of Ruth, when you had Ruth and Naomi, and they came. They had to leave their land, and they had to sell their land, leave their land because there was a famine in the land. So they went to the land of Moab, the whole family, Naomi's family. But there, her sons got married, and then her sons died. So Naomi came back with her daughter-in-law Ruth. Well, they came back. Well, their land was already sold. They had nothing. But Boaz was the closest kinsman redeemer. So he was the one who went out and purchased the land, and he ended up marrying Ruth, and she became basically the great-grandmother of David. All right? But God was trying to instill in them that the kinsman redeemer, that's so important that he's the one, you know, who is in a position to buy back what was taken. Yeah.
Well, what if somebody was sold into slavery and then they died? You know, what happened to their land?
So that's a good question. That's why when God says it's talking about their descendants, in other words, it would go on to his children or to his closest relatives so that the land would always be in the family. All right? So that land was always supposed to revert back to the family that God originally gave it to. Okay? That's what it was pointing to. Now, keep a couple of things in mind. Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. He came down, became one of us. He became our elder brother. We were in a position where we were basically what? We were basically, you know, helpless. We were sold into slavery. Slavery of what? Sin. We couldn't get ourselves out of it. But he came down, became one of us, became our kinsman redeemer, and he purchased with his own blood, you know, our freedom back. And he also purchased with his own blood our world back. But we won't see that deed go into effect until he comes back and he sets up his kingdom himself. All right? So let's go on just a little bit further, because he's tying it in not only with the land, but he's tying it in with people themselves who are sold in slavery or servitude because of financial hardships. He says, 29, he says, likewise, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it is not bought back for him within that space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to its purchaser throughout his generations. It does not revert back to in the Jubilee. The houses of the villages, however, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in a Jubilee. As for the cities of the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which are their possessions. What therefore belongs to the Levites may be redeemed, and a house sale in the city of its possession reversed in the Jubilee, for the houses of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. But pasture fields of their cities shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Let me just explain this before we get into the individual sold into slavery. Basically what he's saying this, okay, is that in the city themselves, okay, if there's a house in the city that was built by somebody and it was sold to another person, well, that person has a right to buy back that house within 1 year. If he doesn't purchase that house back in a year, then that house can remain permanently with whoever bought it. But God makes an exception here. He says, if you happen to be a Levite, then it belongs to you. It always belongs to Levites, because this is what God told them in Exodus, is that God gave land to all the different tribes except Levi. Levi, he divided up the tribe of Levi into 48 different cities. And outside the cities, they were allowed to have pasture land where they could use to pasture sheep or flock or goats or whatever, you know, to help them sustain them monetarily. But God's intention was this. He put the Levites, which were the priestly tribes, in the cities for a very profound reason. Anybody have any idea?
Well, they had to worship in the temple.
Well, the temple was in Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
That's where that's where the priests were at, and that's where they had they could only sacrifice in Jerusalem. They could only sacrifice there at the temple. But all these other cities, there's 48 different cities scattered throughout all of Israel, where the Levites were to dwell in these cities. The Levites were the priestly tribe. The Levites were the ones to teach the people about God, about his laws, about his statutes, about his ordinances. They were the ones that God ordained as being, you know, his spokesmen to his people. You know, they were the ones who would run the synagogues. They were the ones to lead in worship. They were the ones that God commissioned. But he said, you do this in the cities. And I think that he did that for a very specific reason. Because look at our cities today. What's wrong with our cities? Our cities are inundated and flooded and gutted with crime, with immorality, with godlessness, with blasphemers, with swindlers, with crooks. Everything you can imagine concentrates in the cities, doesn't it? It's almost as though what you have here is a situation where when we go through this whole book of Leviticus, we were talking about how God would say that if a person had a certain rash, if he had a certain illness, if he had a certain discharge, that he was supposed to be isolated, he was supposed to be quarantined, he was supposed to be separated from the rest of the people. Why? Because everything that flows from human nature is what? It's contaminated. It's defiled and defiling. Apply this in a spiritual sense, this is what it boils down to. When you have a city, you've got a concentration of sinners in a city. And because of the concentration of these sinners, sin multiplies exponentially just from the sheer concentration of sinful people. So God wanted to put the salt of the earth, the light of the world, the 11-foot society right smack in the middle of that to arrest that kind of spiritual corruption. That's why he said to the Levites, you get the cities. Okay, you occupy the cities. I am your inheritance. And you are there to teach the people about me, you know, about my statutes, about my ordinances, and make sure that they are carried out. Okay, this is what God's intention was for the Levites. So the Levites, if they had a house in the city and they sold it, well, they could always buy that house back, no matter how long it took. And after 50 years, it was to revert back to them. If they didn't have the money to buy it. Because as far as God is concerned, I want these people here to be my witness. And, you know, God has his people everywhere. Remember in the New Testament, Paul talks about, he said, greet those who are of the household of Caesar. In other words, God has people even in Caesar's household because he wants his people to be where they are most needed in terms of being the salt of the earth and the light of the world, leaven of society. A lot of times I think to myself, boy, it'd be really nice to just be surrounded by really committed Christians in your neighborhood. Wouldn't it be nice? You know, mm-hmm. People who are really committed to God, who really knows what it's like and knows what it means to love their neighbor as themselves, love God with a whole heart. Man, it'd be great to live in a neighborhood like that. But no, a lot of times God throws us in neighborhoods or on our jobs, a situation where we around people that we really don't want to be around. But we are supposed to be the ones to arrest the corruption that's there. See, that's why God, you know, had to set down these laws for the Levites, okay?
John, I had a question. Am I missing something about the significance of the wall versus the open country?
Okay, what he's saying here is he's saying when you have a wall around a city, that constitutes a city. But if you have a village, that doesn't count as being a city. Therefore, you know, it doesn't come under the same statutes. In other words, when you're in a city, it has to have a wall around it. That constitutes it as a city. And if you buy a house then, you have a whole year to buy that house back. Unless you're a Levite, you can have the option to buy it back. Now, if you're in a kind of a village area and you buy a house, well, that year doesn't apply. But the year of Jubilee does. For example, what if you had if a person went out there and says, well, gee, I'm broke. Could you buy my land from me? And, you know, you could use it for your crops or whatever. And the person says, sure. And let's just say it's 20 years till Jubilee. Well, he's supposed to prorate that price of the property. So he buys the property, but he knows that in 20 years that property has to go back. Okay? Or if the king's been a redeemer can come in and buy it, he's always eligible to do that. But let's just say the person who bought the property decided, well, I'm going to make myself a little house on this property. So he builds himself a house. Well, too bad, come the year of Jubilee, that house goes along with the property back to its original owner.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if there was a spiritual significance to having a wall around the city versus not.
Well, no, it was just, it defines a city in contrast to a village.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
That's what constitutes a city. That's basically what God is saying. Now, okay, what I want to get into here is dealing with the same subject matter, but now dealing with people who are sold into slavery and can be bought back. Because it says here, 35? It says, now in a case of a countryman of yours who becomes poor and his means with regards to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countrymen may live with you. Basically, what he's saying this is, if your brother, your countryman, has fallen so destitute that he has nothing, then God wants you to take him in and to provide for him. Now, God doesn't mean, hey, well, let him come in and sit on a couch and do nothing but twiddle his thumbs. No, he's going to have to earn his keep, but you need to provide for him, because God is trying to instill in his people this whole concept of loving one's neighbor as themselves. In other words, Jesus himself in the New Testament said, if you even give a cold glass of water in my name, it will not lose its reward, right? If we do something for another person in the name of Jesus Christ, okay, we're basically doing it for him. So God is basically trying to instill in them that what you do to the least of your brethren, you do unto him. All right? In terms of taking care of people who are destitute. All right? Problem was today, we're not in this kind of situation where we can do this, because you got a situation where it's very complex today. I mean, the church can go out there and try to help as many people as they can, and that's what we are supposed to do as a church. Okay? The problem is the government's got their foot into everything, and they just make things 10 times worse. But then again, you got another element out there who have no desire to do anything with their lives but to remain in the streets, because they don't want to be told what to do. I mean, time and time again, our government opens up, you know, places of shelter for these people. And they say, you can come in here, you can get 3 square meals a day, you know, a roof over your head, but you have to adhere to certain rules and do certain things. They say, heck with that, I ain't doing that. So we're in a situation where this isn't really applicable to us in some respects, but it's still applicable to us in terms of the spirit that God is trying to instill in us, as far as loving our neighbor as ourselves, and whatever we do to the least of our brother, we do unto him. But he says here at verse 38, says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. And if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner with you until the year of Jubilee. He shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family, that he may return to the property of his forefathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold in a slave sale. You shall not rule over him with severity, but you are to revere your God. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may acquire male and female slaves from your pagan nations that are around you. Then too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they have produced in your land, they also may become your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive a possession. You can use them as a permanent slaves, but in respect to your countrymen of the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. Now, if the means of a stranger or a sojourner with you becomes sufficient, and this countryman of yours becomes so poor with the regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemptive rights after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle or his uncle's sons may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives or his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He then, with his purchaser, shall calculate from the year when he sold himself to him to the year of Jubilee, and the price of his sale shall correspond to the number of years. It is like the days of a hired man that he shall be with him. If there are still many years, he shall refund part of his purchase price in proportion to them to his own redemption. And if few years remain until the year of Jubilee, he shall so calculate with him in proportion to his years. He is to refund the amount for his redemption. Like a man hired by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. Even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out in the year of Jubilee, he and his sons with him. For the sons of Israel are my servants, they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt, and I am the Lord your God. Okay, now he covers a lot of ground here. But let's just break it down in a couple segments. First of all, when reading this chapter, there's no doubt in my mind that our early forefathers who were in favor of slavery could take a chapter like this out of the Bible and justify slavery. Well, God is in no way, shape, or form justifying slavery here any more than he justified, let's say, bigamy. All right? It was an institution that was just a fact of life. It was during the days of Paul. Because Paul didn't condemn slavery, he just simply said, hey, this is a fact of life. So he gave specific instructions to slaves or to servants, as well as to masters. And he made it abundantly clear in the New Testament, and he said, hey, in Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither male nor female. There's neither slave nor free. We are all one in Christ. We are all equal as far as God is concerned. No one's better than another. All right? Slavery is still commonplace in certain parts of the world. All right, so God is just giving some very specific instructions to both slaves and slave owners. But the spiritual parallel goes further than that, because who did Jesus say was a slave? Who was the real slave?
He who sins.
Yeah, he says, he who sins is a slave to sin. Okay. No question about it. We are all born into that slavery. There's no doubt about it. Each and every one of us, are born with this cursed nature that makes us enslaved to sin. But when he says, but if the Son shall set you free, you shall be free indeed. So we give our life over to Christ, and this slavery of sin, this yoke, is broken. We are no longer need to be dominated by a sinful nature. Why? Because we now have been empowered from on high to be able to overcome our human weaknesses and our frailties that had so enslaved us to our sins and our lust and so on, our selfishness and our greed and so on and so forth, right? But what he's saying here in the physical sense is this. If your countryman becomes very poor and he needs to sell himself into slavery, he says here, oh, you can buy him back. You can redeem him. His closest kinsman should do that. He wasn't obligated to do that, but he was certainly expected to do that if he was in a financial position to do so. Same thing with us today. Spiritually speaking, if we have a brother or sister in Christ who's walking with the Lord, but then through circumstances and bad choices and judgments and so on and so forth, they start backsliding back into their old ways, and they become a slave again to their old lifestyles. We, as their closest kinsmen, in other words, brothers and sisters, we really do need to have an obligation to go to try to bring that person back into freedom in terms of reaching out to them in the name of Christ, trying to get them back from the bad choices that they've made, to bring them back to a proper relationship with Jesus Christ. Okay, that's the goal. That's the aim. All right? But he also makes some distinctions here. He's saying this, that if it happens to be your countryman and he sells himself to you, okay, see, if he's a fellow Jew, you're not to treat him as a servant or as a slave. You are to treat him as a hired hand. You are to really show him that kind of respect and dignity because, what, he is your brother. Here's your blood brother, and you don't treat him as a slave. Now, in reading this, like I said, you almost get the impression, well, God is condoning slavery. That as far as God is concerned, he's legitimizing it. No, he's not. He's just dealing with an institution that's already in place. And as a matter of fact, you go back to the book of Exodus, I think it's Exodus chapter 20, or 21 rather. God says specifically that if a master were to knock out a slave's tooth, that slave was to be set free. Okay? If the master was to injure his slave in any way like that, any permanent kind of injury, whether it was eye, his hand, his limb, that slave was to go free. If the slave was killed by his master, that master was to be executed. There was different other regulations that God set down. Because, let's face it, in these days, people just felt like, well, this person is my property. And if I want to kill that person, then it would be no different than me taking a piece of my property and destroying it. I couldn't be held responsible for that. What God was trying, you know, Willie instituted there some laws to protect slaves, even to the point that if they were if they were abused, they were to be set free. These were the kind of laws that God was instituting in the face of a very abhorrent institution. All right, but keep a couple things in mind. You know, I think there's an interesting episode in the book of Jeremiah where because the people were so wicked and they were so evil that God said he was going to destroy Jerusalem and have the people incarcerated off into Babylon. And so what happened was that Nebuchadnezzar surrounded the city and he laid it under siege. And, you know, his armies had basically overrun the land. Well, the people were now inside the city. And they knew this was judgment from God, and they wanted to get right with God. Well, the sabbatical year came up where they were supposed to allow all the slaves to go free. Well, they said, well, let's honor God by setting our slaves free, and God will be gracious to us, and he'll, you know, call off the dogs. In other words, call off Nebuchadnezzar. So what happened was the people, they entered into a solemn covenant with God. Here the enemies are outside besieging the city, and they're inside, and they want to get right with God. So they take the sacrificial animals, they cut them in half. This was the way that they would make a solemn vow. And then they separate the halves of the animals, and then all the people making the vow would walk between the halves of these sacrificial animals, showing that they are one with this vow, and they're making basically a vow to God with their life as they pass through this this life in this covenant they're making with God. And they made this covenant with God, and then they said, okay, we'll set all of our servants free. All of our slaves can go free because we're going to observe, we're going to obey God, and then we're going to observe this seventh year where the slaves can be set free. Well, what happened is right after that, Nebuchadnezzar was camped outside the city, but then he got word that the king of Egypt was coming up against him to fight him with his army. So Nebuchadnezzar pulled up all of his stakes, all of his camps, took all of his men, and took off towards Egypt to meet Pharaoh, and he went down there and kicked the snot out of him. Well, the people, when they saw that Nebuchadnezzar's whole army had pulled up and left, they said, hey, great, you know, our prayers have been answered. And they said, we're free. And then they started looking around and said, hey, man, what do we do? We let our slaves go. It says, get the slaves back, get the slaves back, get them back. It says, we need them now more than ever, you know, because they figure out, we need people to draw water and to rebuild what's been broken down. And so they went right back on their word, and they got all their slaves back. And Jeremiah said, boy, you guys have blown it. God is putting you to the test, and you've blown it. And then Nebuchadnezzar came back and did completely destroyed them. But you see what's at stake here? It's the greed. It's the selfishness. Okay, the self-centeredness that, you know, we see that's so prevalent in our society today, where what matters most is it God? No. Is it obeying God? No. I mean, you know, it's money. It's material things. I mean, today, you can see it, and it just angers me to no end, how we've gotten to the point in our society where animals literally are more protected and more loved and more appreciated than human beings. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's the way they had gotten in Nazi Germany. So many of the Nazi German people considered themselves to be good people because they didn't like to see an animal suffer. But look what they did to human beings. What we see here is just nothing has changed in terms of human nature. All of this is set forth for what? For our example, for our reproof, for our instruction. So even when we read something like this that seems so totally out of date, so irrelevant as far as we are concerned, it still has its very profound spiritual significance. And that is, when a person is sold into slavery, we have an obligation to get them back. It says here that if a person was so destitute, a Jewish person, an Israelite, was so destitute that he could only find a foreigner to buy him back, then God says, hey, you've got a responsibility to go buy him back from that foreigner. Now, if he sold himself to his countrymen, he could still be bought back by his kinsman and redeemer, but you know, his situation wasn't as desperate. And so now we look around and we see people that are, you know, in a spiritual realm, in a spiritual sense, are in destitute situations. where they have become enslaved by the devil, by their sins, by so many other things that the world, the flesh, the devil, and you know, we really do need to reach out to them to try to bring them back. That's what this is really dealing with here. All right, that's what it's really pointing to. Does anybody want to have anything they want to add or share? You know, or anything I may have failed to mention when we're dealing with this. This is a very tough chapter. Okay, this is a very, very tough book. But just keep a couple of things in mind. Everything in it has a spiritual parallel. And don't forget that that year of Jubilee, it was to be celebrated every 50th year, and it was supposed to be celebrated on the Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement was the most solemn day in the Jewish calendar. That was the day that they took two goats, and the high priest would lay his hands upon the head of one goat, transfer all the sins of the nation onto this one goat. And there was another goat there that the priest did not lay his hands on. Well, they took this guilty goat, where all the sins were transmitted onto this guilty goat. They took the guilty goat, and they took him outside the city, and they took him out. They took him way, way away, and they let him go free. Mm-hmm. And the innocent goat, they butchered up and offered up as a sin offering. So it pointed to Christ. The guilty one was set free. Mm-hmm. The innocent one was slaughtered as a sin offering. That's why the year of Jubilee was to be celebrated on the Day of Atonement. That's why the trumpets would be blown, because it points back to the fact that, you know, we are set free because, and the innocent one died in our place.